Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Well, welcome back. Let's go around and say our names. I'm Jim.
Andy.
Rusty.
Max.
Scott.
And Jessica.
No, not so fast.
Harry.
David.
Patrick.
I'm Mark.
Ryan.
Philip.
John.
My name is Gary.
My name is Michael.
Michael.
I'm Henry.
I'm Adam.
I'm George.
Brad.
I'm Brad.
David.
Jack.
My name is Ray.
I'm Sean Boone.
I'm Clint.
I'm Sadachita.
Gary.
Craig.
Frank.
Don.
Michael.
My name is Joe.
I'm Hal.
My name is Brian.
Peter.
Jason.
Paul.
Dan.
Dan. Great. How many of you are here for the first time? Welcome. How many are here after a long absence? Welcome. We're lucky to have our old friend Tom Moon here today. He's a well-known and highly regarded therapist in the gay world and beyond. He was one of the early pillars of this community. He was the first speaker coordinator, I believe. And he has a special relationship with Spirit Rock, and we try and get him back at least once a year. And his therapy combines the insights of Buddhism and contemporary therapeutic insights. So thank you, Tom, in advance for letting me feel a little bit of your thoughts.
Thank you. Well, good morning. The subject I want to talk about today is moments of awakening, or as they're often called in the Western world, mystical experiences, which we don't talk about too much. It's just a subject I love. There's a tradition, or a literature rather, going back thousands of years in every one of the spiritual traditions of these experiences where people have these moments, often completely unpredictable or unprepared for, moments of spiritual awakening that change their lives. And reading them can be quite inspiring, and that's one of the reasons I like to read them. So what I want to do is share three of my favorite ones, three accounts of my favorite mystical awakenings, and then talk a little bit about what the Buddha had to say about what they mean, what their strengths and weaknesses, and what the pitfalls are of these kind of experiences. And maybe we'll have some time for some conversation too. So the first one I want to read is the awakening experience of Arthur Koestler, Hungarian-born writer, author of Darkness at Noon. During the Spanish Civil War, he was arrested by the fascists and thrown into solitary confinement, accused of being a communist, which he was at that time. And that was bad news then, because that was a capital offense at the time, and you could be shot just for being a communist. So he was in pretty dire straits. And in the middle of the night, often while he was there, he would hear other prisoners being dragged out of their cells and shot. And there was no way of knowing that wasn't going to happen to him. So, and he had nothing to read or no communication with anybody, you know, no cell phone, nothing. So what he did was he took a spring out of his mattress and he used it to write on the stone wall. And he was a smart guy. He studied mathematics. So he was doing mathematics on the wall, and he was trying to remember Euclid's proof that the number of prime numbers is infinite. So he works out the proof, and he managed to remember it. And he was standing there imagining his handiwork and thinking about how, wow, you know, the infinite is something that the human mind can't understand. And yet the human mind can say very definite things about it that aren't all vague and mysterious. And as he was thinking that, suddenly this wave of something came over him. And what he writes about it is this. The wave had originated in an articulate verbal insight, but this evaporated at once, leaving in its wake only a wordless essence, a fragrance of eternity, a quiver in the arrow of the blue. I must have stood there for some minutes entranced with a wordless awareness that this is perfect, perfect, until I noticed some slight mental discomfort nagging at the back of my mind, some trivial circumstance that marred the perfection of the moment. Then I remember the nature of that irrelevant annoyance. I was, of course, in prison and might be shot. But this was immediately answered by a feeling whose verbal translation would be, so what? Is that all? Have you got nothing more serious to worry about? An answer so spontaneous, fresh, and amused, as if the intruding annoyance had been the loss of a collar stud. Then I was floating on my back in a river of peace under bridges of silence. It came from nowhere and flowed nowhere. Then there was no river and no I. The I had ceased to exist. And then he tries to describe what he was experiencing. He said, verbal transcriptions that come nearest to it are the unity and interlocking of everything that exists, an interdependence like that of gravitational fields or communicating vessels. The I ceases to exist because it has, by a kind of mental osmosis, established communication with and been dissolved in the universal pool. It is the process of dissolution and limitless expansion which is sensed as the oceanic feeling, as the draining of all tension, the absolute catharsis, the peace that passeth all understanding. So what happened with this man was that he had these experiences often a couple times a day while he was in prison, and then less frequently later on in his life, and they became the foundation for a new way of living. He studied Buddhism in Japan and yoga in India. He never committed to any spiritual tradition or any beliefs of any kind, but he said that these became the foundation for a new way of life for him. And before he died, he talked about the oceanic feeling that he experienced as removing his fear of death. So the second one is the experience of Thomas Merton, who many of you know, I'm sure. He was a Trappist monk, a Catholic Trappist monk, who wrote a lot of beautiful stuff on mysticism. He was one of the first Catholics to study Zen Buddhism. He practiced Zazen, became a good friend of D.T. Suzuki, and thought that there was a fruitful dialogue and exchange to be had between Catholicism and Buddhism. But before all that happened, he was still a Trappist monk. He was living in Kentucky, and he was smug, by his own admission, kind of thought he was living some kind of special holy existence, and he was better than us lay people, you know. And then he had this experience, which I'll read, in Louisville. Today, there in Louisville, there's a plaque on the spot in the shopping center where he had this. There really is this commemorating this experience that he had that changed his life. It's kind of cool. And I think this whole quote is on the plaque. So this is what he wrote. In Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all these people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another even though we were total strangers. It was like waking from a dream of separateness, of spurious self-isolation in the special world of renunciation and supposed holiness. The whole illusion of a separate holy existence is a dream. This sense of liberation from an illusory difference was such a relief and such a joy to me that I almost laughed out loud. And I suppose my happiness could have taken form in the words, thank God that I am like other men, that I am only a man among others. It is a glorious destiny to be a member of the human race, though it is a race dedicated to many absurdities and one which makes many terrible mistakes. A member of the human race. To think that such a commonplace realization should suddenly seem like news that one holds the winning ticket in a cosmic sweepstake. And if only everybody could realize this. But it can't be explained. There's no way of telling people that they are all walking around shining like the sun. They are not they, but my own self. There are no strangers. Then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts, the depths of their heart where neither sin nor desire nor self-knowledge can reach, the core of their reality. If only they could all see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way all the time. There would be no more war, no more hatred, no more cruelty, no more greed. I suppose the big problem would be that we would all fall down and worship each other. I love that. That was a good day for me. And the third one is, the final one, is Byron Katie's awakening experience. You know who she is? She's this. She's a homegrown, world-renowned spiritual teacher from Barstow, California. And before this moment, she was, by her own description, a total mess. She was an alcoholic. She was so depressed she couldn't get out of bed. She was overweight. And she wound up in a halfway house in Bakersfield, California, for women with eating disorders. And one morning, she was sleeping on the floor. She woke up in the morning, and there was a cockroach climbing over her leg. And that was her moment of awakening. She says, in that instant, all my rage, all the thoughts that had been troubling me, my whole world was gone. The only thing that existed was awareness. I was seeing without concepts, without thoughts or a story. There was no me, the foot and the cockroach weren't outside me. There was no outside or inside. She writes, in that moment, it's like, it, capital IT, opened its eyes, and it looked, and it had never been born before, and it was awake, and it saw everything. It had no name, no recognition, no identification. For it or what it saw, there was nothing. And then I noticed the mind, and in that moment, laughter was born. It just rolled out because it recognized that none of my thoughts were true, and it was wisdom that could see past everything. So I inquired within that moment. Before the thought, no problem. And then the thought comes, and we believe it. That's where the whole world is created. And thought brought imaginary form with it and a whole world, basically. And then she sums up what this experience taught her. I discovered that basically when I believe my thoughts, I suffer. And when I don't believe my thoughts, I don't suffer. And I've come to see that this is true for every human being. So she went through this very sudden transformation, and she teaches this really interesting form of self-inquiry, where she asks four questions. I use it sometimes in my work. It's a great form of cognitive therapy, if nothing else. But it's a way of using the mind to get beyond the mind, basically. And it came out of this experience. So those are my three experiences, and the thing that this shows me that people who studied this experience say is that there's a sort of family resemblance among these experiences. They seem to be a kind of human experience which arise in all cultures. The experience is very sudden. There's no preparation. The experience is one of immense, a sense of freedom, expansiveness, and joy. But, you know, it isn't just a Julie Andrews moment, because the experience is a response to what is seen. Mystical experience always presents itself as a kind of personal revelation into something that hadn't been seen before, some truth about the nature of things that was hidden before. And there's a sense of being more alive, more understanding than before. And usually when people have this experience, it's so self-evident that they can't doubt it. They can doubt it later when they think about it. But usually at the moment, it's just so obvious that they've just seen something that's quite true. Let's see. So, and then what happens is, you know, there's this difference between your ordinary waking life and this kind of experience. People begin to see themselves almost like they're two separate beings. Aldous Huxley used to say that human beings are amphibians. We live in the spiritual world and the material world simultaneously. And Sogyal Rinpoche in the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying says, two people have been living in you all your life. One is the ego, garrulous, demanding, hysterical, calculating. The other is the hidden spiritual being, whose still voice of wisdom you have only rarely heard or attended to. So how people interpret these experiences vary, you know, not surprisingly, everybody tends to interpret them within their own spiritual tradition. So Christians, anyone in the theistic religions would probably see these experiences as grace or as union with God. In Buddhism, you know, see beyond the ego, they would use terms like the deathless, the unborn, or Buddha nature, or no words at all. And then people who have no, like Alfred Kessler remained a lifelong agnostic, had no spiritual tradition at all. He saw it in terms of, he did not come to any theories about it. You don't have to. And then Byron Katie, kind of like the Buddha in the sense that she has says, I have no beliefs. She says that direct contact with reality is something that you can't put into words, and she kind of leaves it at that. So, but most people who have the experience of see it as religious, you know, it's definitely interpreted that way. There's usually a sense that that I am not who I thought I was. That maybe the personal self, the ego, doesn't really exist or doesn't exist in the way that I thought I did. There's some kind of unity. This is the kind of ideas that these experiences point toward. In the 60s, my spiritual life started with one of these kind of experiences, so that's why this interests me so much personally. But in the 60s, they weren't really all that well understood. I remember when I was in college, people would advertise meditation groups and yoga classes and stuff, which were still kind of exotic in the West in those days. They would say, these are ways of getting high without drugs. Because the point was, we knew about mystical experience. There was a lot of literature coming out about it. And it's good. It's high. You're high. And getting high, of course, is very important. And so it was kind of the end and purpose of spiritual life was to get high. And in fact, an enlightened being was described as a person who gets high but doesn't come down. So you'd be permanently high. Ram Dass, you know, I love Ram Dass. He was became a deeply spiritual man. But when he went and met his guru, Nyan Karoli Baba, and had this great experience and came back to America and did a tour all around the country describing what he'd learned. And, he was naive. He was a beginner in those days. And I remember hearing one of his talks. He said, trying to explain the great exalted state that he believed his guru lived in, he said, Nyan Karoli Baba is having an orgasm from every pore of his body, 24/7. To me, in my 20s, that sounded really hot. They have that? Damn, I got to get some religion, you know? So that was really, it's amazing when I think back on how much as yoga and Buddhism and Hindu practices have come into the West, how really much we've matured since those days. It is kind of amazing how, you know, when I look back on it, or even if you read Be Here Now, that it's a classic book, but you know, you read it, it's a little, you know. I used to read it on acid, and it really made a lot of sense. I shouldn't say all this. What the Buddha actually had a lot of these experiences too. Early in his spiritual quest, you know, he started studying forms of meditation, and so the story goes, he was able to achieve deep one-pointed concentration and would have experiences of infinite consciousness and deep insights, and he called them raptures. And I guess he had these sound like mystical experiences to me. And he thought, wow, this is the greatest of all worldly pleasure to be able to have this. And for a while he thought, this is it, you know. And so he'd have one of his experiences, and he'd be deep in it, and then, you know, he'd have to get up and go to the bathroom or something, or it would fade, as all experiences do. And so what he discovered was, you know, damn, these experiences have the same limitations as all other experiences. Namely, they arise, they stay for a while, and they pass away. They can't be clung to. They're not a secure refuge because they go, for one thing. And he had two, based on his experiences, he had two opinions of these experiences. On the one hand, he called them the gateway to nirvana, because they do, you know, he really did see them as important openings into the nature of reality. So he didn't just dismiss them, but he also called them the corruption of insight. When you cling to them, when you grasp onto them, and or try to do things to induce them as if that's the whole purpose of spiritual life. You know, you can induce them by taking drugs. I mean, acid and psilocybin and mushroom, all those things. They can induce those kinds of experiences. And again, in the 60s, that's what a lot of us were doing, you know. But the point is that what these experiences do is they show us a possibility. They show us, wow, life can be a lot different than I thought. My ordinary, dull-witted, day-to-day perception of reality is not the whole story. There's more to what we can experience than most of us are used to. And then once you have an experience like this, the way I've experienced it is that they set the compass of the heart. You know something you didn't know before. You know a possibility. You have a direction to where you want to go, even if you don't know how to get there. And we didn't know what to do with these experiences in the 60s because, you know, our spiritual traditions were pretty, decadent in this culture. We didn't know what to do. Thomas Merton, the second person I read, he felt that Christianity in the West had become decadent because it was all talk. It was all ideas, you know, theology, beliefs. You have to believe in probable things, and that's religion. And any kind of direct experience or openness or anything like that was sort of not really pursued or talked about. So that we had no language to talk about the experience of spiritual life. And my experience was that was true. I was raised in the Catholic tradition, and they had talk of these. They had talk about this stuff, the beatific vision and stuff. But usually, that was something that was supposed to happen after you died, or to saints, you know. And it was usually accompanied by levitation, which, you know, Thomas Aquinas, he was the great theologian, the Catholic theologian. At the end of his life, he had a mystical experience. He'd by then written like an encyclopedia of theology, and he had this mystical experience and said, "Everything I wrote is straw compared to this." But when he had it, apparently it said that he was seen levitating in front of a crucifix. So that's the kind of thing I always thought. It's like, yeah, probably not. You know, and there was a kind of skepticism about the, you know, because it was all wrapped up in the miraculous. But so what the Eastern traditions have known, have always known, is that these experiences are more central in Hinduism, and they certainly are in Buddhism. I mean, Buddhism begins with the awakening, which I think was a mystical experience, of the Buddha, the night of his awakening. The Maha mystical experience, you could say. The most influential one of all time. So they're more familiar with this stuff and have developed traditions for understanding it, nurturing it, and learning from it without getting lost in it. And what they all said, what all these traditions say, is that the fundamental path that you have to start with, in once you've had the experience, once you've seen the possibility, what you then do to be on a path is, the first thing is, and this was not new, happy news in the 60s, was ethics. You have to begin living an ethical life, cleaning up your act. So, for instance, Byron Katie was alcoholic. I don't think I mentioned that when she had her awakening. And, of course, she had to stop drinking and get her life straight. Not because drinking is bad, but because having an experience like that taught her that her mind, her awareness, is meant for a higher purpose. And you have to clear away whatever obstacle gets in the way. So ethics is about... These kind of experiences teach you a goal, and then the ethics is how you get there. And since they typically show us that the individual self is either not what it appears to be or it's illusory, and that the individual self is a kind of prison, which is one of the central beliefs in Buddhism. So the ethical life is about opening to others. It's about opening to service, opening to compassion, opening to love. One of the principles I love in Buddhism, one of the phrases that I really inspires me is the phrase, what is it? Give no one cause to fear you. That's how we should live according to this principle. Give no one cause to fear you. Which I would have thought was really naive growing up. I mean, where I grew up, you know, you had to, boys anyway, you had to look tough and armored and, you know, don't fuck with me. You had to look like that, you know. Otherwise you get beat up on the way home from school. And then in academic life and professional life later, there you had to learn other ways, more sophisticated ways of armoring yourself and defending yourself against other people. I was, just for fun, I made a list of the techniques I learned. Here we go. Self-righteousness, irritation, edginess and impatience, caustic, sarcastic or withering tones, condescension, ridicule, humiliation and argumentativeness, sighs and eye rolls, prosecutorial questions, high-handedness, and put-downs. What a way to live. But we've all done this, and this kind of thing just seems like common sense, unless you have something to compare that way of life to. And when you've had an awakening, what you begin to see is that this is a way of living in prison. And that the more we can open ourselves, the more our suffering begins to end. So that's how mystical experience, I think, begins to teach us. It begins to inform us. The ideal of unselfish love, you know, ethics in most people's minds, if it's not spiritually grounded, is it's about being nice. It's about being good. And but it's, you know, once you've had an experience like this, then the ideal becomes something more like getting your ego out of the way so that you can be a conduit in which that spiritual energy flows into the world. So it's a much more I don't know, inspiring kind of ideal, and a much more exacting one. So compassion just doesn't mean being nice to people and smiling at strangers on the street and stuff. It really means, you know, a kind of openness, working at a kind of openness that we don't typically do, that people don't typically do. There's a modern translation of a poem by Hafiz that I love, which expresses this ideal perfectly. This is a modern translation, so you know you'll hear the anachronism in it. He says, "Admit something. Everyone you see, you say to them, 'Love me.' Of course, you don't do this out loud, otherwise somebody would call the cops. Still, though, think about this great pull in us to connect. Why not become the one who lives with a full moon in each eye that is always saying with that sweet moon language what every other eye in this world is dying to hear?" I mean, what a beautiful ideal, you know. Because most of us think, most of the time we think of compassion or love especially, as being on the receptive end of it. I mean, there's a lot of unselfish love in this world, just looking at what parents do with their kids, the sacrifices they make every day. Or just watching a guy throw a ball, and the other day I was watching this throw gun, a guy for his dog. You know, the dog is just the most wonderful thing that ever happened. The ball's in the air, oh my God, look at it. You know, these dogs are so easily pleased. He's bored to tears, you know. But he's throwing the ball because he loves his dog, you know. So it's simple little things like that. There is a lot of unselfish love in the world. But so much of the time, we think of love in terms of being on the receiving end of it, of receiving it, you know. I think one of the dominant religions in America is romantic love. It's based on the idea, you know, there's my soulmate out there, the one person who was specially created to meet all my needs, who will be of great sex, of course, but will always know, love, you know, anticipate all my desires without my ever having to say anything, will heal all my childhood wounds and so on. This is the right, there's a faith in this culture in romantic love that is religious, if you ask me. So, anyway, then the other thing that all the traditions talk about is the need to train the mind. I think Buddhism emphasizes this the most. That the idea is that the spiritual voice in us, except when it's shouting in these mystical experiences, is a very quiet, soft voice, easily drowned out by the noise of the world and our own inner turmoil and desires. And so that in order to hear, we have to make the mind quiet and receptive and listen, you know. In theistic traditions and in Christianity, it's often said that, I can't remember what it said now. Oh well, it'll come back to me in a minute. I'm old. The voice speaks softly. Oh yeah. If you cannot turn toward God unless you turn away from self, which is a very interesting idea in there. So that if you want to open to the spiritual life, you have to stop focusing so much on your own individual stuff. And one of the ways you do that is through meditation. So Sogyal Rinpoche describes it this way. Above all, be at ease. Be as natural and spacious as possible. Slip quietly out of the noose of your habitual anxious self. Release all grasping and relax into your true nature. Think of your ordinary, emotional, thought-ridden self as a block of ice or a slab of butter left out in the sun. If you're feeling hard and cold, let this aggression melt away in the sunlight of your meditation. Let peace work on you and enable you to gather your scattered mind into the mindfulness of calm abiding and awaken in you the awareness and insight of clear seeing. And you'll find all your negativity disarmed, your aggression dissolved, and your confusion evaporating slowly into like mist into the vast and stainless sky of your absolute nature. It's quite beautiful. This is how I think, this is Tibetan Buddhism, how they speak of the what is seen in mysticism, the absolute, the stainless and vast sky of your absolute nature. So, and what happens, I think, is if we can make the mind quiet regularly, these kind of awakening experiences are more likely to happen. The more quiet we become, the more this kind of guidance or whatever it is occurs, or is likely to occur, although there's no way to make it happen. And grasping it is just another form of clinging, which creates suffering. But we can live a life in alignment with the highest in us, and we can be inspired by our highest moments, so that, because so many of our moments are dull and mean in this world, but we can keep what we've experienced as an ideal. And then you begin to, ideally, begin to see the real nature of existence. As Kala Rinpoche says, this is a good example of a mystical utterance in Buddhism that I'll talk about. He says, you've heard this before, I'm sure, we live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. You are that reality. When you understand this, you see that you're nothing. And being nothing, you are everything. That is all. So I have to say, the first time I heard this, I thought, what the hell does that mean? You're nothing, so you're everything. Mm-hmm. The thing is that almost all mystical statements are paradoxical like this, because their purpose really is to remind us that the nature of this life and the nature of who we really are is beyond what the mind can comprehend. But the heart can know and love it intimately, because the heart in us is that reality. And the more we come to know this, the more we discover inside ourselves a deep peace and a joy that this world, for all its horrors, can never touch, I think. So that's my whole act. We have about 10, 15 minutes for conversation, questions, or anything you want to say. Sir?
You know, my first religious experience was on acid.
Yeah.
And I was reading, at the time I was reading Martin Buber, for a class, and all of a sudden it started to make sense to me.
Yeah. You know?
And I wrote my term paper on my acid experience, and I got an A on it. But, I didn't start taking acid every day, but it did. It was a framework for me to look back on and see that what happened with that. Now, my guess is there's a lot of drugs going on in Buddhism, in ancient Buddhism, maybe in contemporary. I mean, don't they smoke like opium and shit like that? And
I don't know.
In Thailand?
Do they?
I mean, I bet there's a lot of this going on, and they just don't want to talk about it.
Well, drugs have been used. The Native American peyote ceremonies and so on. And I don't know, other people may have had deep spiritual experiences on acid or peyote, too. Anyone? I mean, yeah, it's not that uncommon. These drugs can induce or can be a gateway to these kind of experiences. What? Oh hi. You're back, Mike. He was in Ireland. So, what was I going to say about this? Yeah, these experiences, they can open you to reality. And I would not discount that at all, or say that they were unreal, just because, I mean, look, that's what Ram Dass, he was Richard Alpert, he took acid, he got kicked out of Harvard, then went to India to find out, what do I do about these experiences? I've seen something. And then that was what started his quest, and he became Ram Dass as a result. So I think but he said too that if you're taking these drugs all the time, that's just going back to see the possibility. Once you know this, whatever this is, then you need to stop and do the path, which is what his was yoga, Ashtanga yoga. So I would never discount these experiences because they're induced by drugs.
I also had similar experiences, and I, as a former Catholic, was trying to break out of that particular framework I had been handed. But it was also, for me, complicated back in the 60s by my knowledge that I was gay and not knowing where that fit in. Over the years, I've come to feel that my queer consciousness was a blessing, and I feel that as a tribe, we have this particular gift, which is early on, we start questioning the ideas and framework about the world that we are handed. So I was working on integrating that. In fact, I felt the whole challenge was once you go up into that elevated space and then you come back, how do you integrate it into your daily life?
Yeah.
Because you cannot exist being up there all the time when you have this impermanent body to keep feeding and earning money for and, you know, living life on this particular plane.
Yeah. I discovered I was gay in 1962, so that's 7 years before Stonewall, and it was a trauma, major, because I'd never heard anything good said about gay. It was such a different world from today. I mean, it's hard to even remember in a way, but it was deeply wounding, and I remember what I felt was, I'm cut off. I was Catholic. I'm cut off from God. I'm cut off from the Spirit. I'm cut off from other people. I will never be respected, etc. And spiritually, there was a sense of spiritual weightlessness, because we were perverts. Perversion means against truth, turning away from truth. So it's like how we got here, I don't know, but we weren't supposed to be here, right? It was weird. So there was a sense of weightlessness. And I remember when I had my first awakening, and this was not on drugs, the later ones were, it was so healing because suddenly there was a sense of, oh no, not only do I belong here, I'm in a sense all there is. This is the whole of reality. You know what I mean? I'm deep, you know, I'm, you know, not just meant to be here, I'm existence itself. It's, you know, it's the way that you can express. And boy, is that a healing experience. And that, I think that's how genuine spiritual experience can really heal trauma, especially including these traumas that people of our age, I assume that's similar, have experienced. Oh, and then Jim, you had your hand up.
Right?
Yeah.
It's interesting that you talked about this in the three examples. I didn't hear anything from you. Have you had that experience, or did you refer to a series of different experiences? And secondly, I'm a little, it's a skeptical question, although I don't feel skeptical about it, to set these experiences as sort of aside and implicitly better than ordinary common reality, which I think if you're paying attention, which I only do a little bit, is miraculous in itself. That I look in the window box and a plant is this big and the next day it's that big is incredible. Mm-hmm. And so that's, as a couple weeks ago I referred to, I've been reading Stephen Batchelor's Buddhism Without Beliefs, in which he says, he makes a statement that over the course of centuries in Buddhism, the experience of awakening has been set upon this pedestal as this amazing, single, life-changing illumination in which, although he says that his awakening is actually part of experience of reality.
Yeah.
If you can react to any of those. Oh,
I can react to all those.
Yeah. Speaking of Catholicism, which I'm not from, but I was in Italy last fall. Can't be more Catholic than Italians.
Yeah, no.
And there are a lot of revered mystics and saints who today would be sedated.
Yeah, right.
They, I mean, St. Catherine in Siena woke up one morning and said she'd married Jesus the night before, and she, and then she missed a few people. And her wedding ring was Christ's foreskin. And she is...
Damn.
Weird. A little detail you don't often hear.
And she lactated, too.
And she lactated.
Oh, she did?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was always embarrassed.
Yeah. So that's a whole bundle of something to think. Can you just sort out, what kind of answer can you give to
The foreskin thing, that's cool. I didn't know that. I hadn't heard that.
It's
creepy. Well, I don't know. Yeah. Mysticism and lunacy in many people are close friends. I mean, you know, I think Ramakrishna, for instance, is Hindu mystic, who I'm convinced was a gay man. But anyway... you know, he was going off into these ecstasies all the time. I think the guy was probably nuts in such a in some way. But I would envy his experiences at the same time. Madness and mysticism can often be very closely related. But the other question, Stephen Batchelor, I have a lot of trouble with Stephen Batchelor, personally. Yeah, because I think the... Well, to get argumentative, I think the Buddhism he offers is what I would call rational materialism in drag. So we can argue about that. You know, he's a very dedicated man. He's spent years as a monastic. He's certainly been more dedicated than I ever will be. But I think that he wants the Buddha to be David Hume, you know? So we can argue about that. I mean, I have views, you know, I have strong opinions about some things and statements. The other thing about mystical experience, he says that we can set these experiences up as the goal and the great thing to have. Well, for all these three people, these experiences, they weren't a goal particularly, they just occurred, but they were experiences they remembered for the rest of their lives, and those experiences did change their lives. So, I'll talk about my experience if you want, my experiences, but that was true of me too. Now, once you've had those experiences and begin doing the work of, you know, cleansing the doors of perception, so to speak, then I think you can see eternity in a grain of sand and, you know, and see the beauty of a plant and begin to be open to the mystery of existence right here and now. But for a lot of us, for me anyway, it takes the awakening to point to that, to begin to see. Because when I'm closed and all wrapped up in my preoccupations, that's not how I experience life. You know what I mean? So I think that's the goal of spiritual life, is that ordinary life, that, you know, samsara is nirvana, that this what we have right now is plenty. But it's hard to see that for so many of us without a path, and often without a little kick from the universe. My own experience, when I was 20, I was sophomore in college, and I was out walking one day, and I was kind of depressed. I was dealing with my late adolescent angst and gay stuff, you know, and hadn't had sex with anybody yet and was dying to. And I was dealing with all my problems, and I was weighed down, and midterms were coming up, and it was like that. I was walking in this little wooded area or brush area that's now all houses down there in Belmont. And all of a sudden, I just, you know, it was just opened up. And I don't know why. I started running, and I was joyful and tried to put it into words, but it just felt like the universe is alive in some way. And I'm not just one with it, I am the whole thing in some strange sense. There is only one. There is only one being. Very difficult to put any of this into words. It sounds woo-woo and crazy when you try to describe it. It can't be. It's ineffable. These experiences can't be described. And I had no. I'd been raised Catholic. I'd become an atheist by age 15. I didn't have any, and I knew nothing. I had no way of describing this. I went back to college and described it to a friend of mine. He said, "Oh, you had a peak experience. You should read Maslow." You know, so I read Abraham Maslow on peak experiences, and then I read Alan Watts' The Way of Zen, which I thought was really cool, and Satori. I learned the term Satori, which I seemed to be what I had experienced. And then these experiences just happened through the rest of my life. Usually, when I go on meditation retreats, they almost always happen at some point, and usually not when I'm sitting, but when I'm doing walking meditation. I don't know why, but it's a fair. And now, it's been 40 some odd years of having this kind of stuff. It's in the background all the time for me. There's a sort of sense of this connectedness that's just there. I forget, but it's never too far away. So it feels like there's been some evolution for me. And I haven't done that much spiritual work either, so the return on my investment has been pretty good. Have you had these experiences, or do you want to say?
No, I don't want to say. I like that. Well,
because it's personal,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah, yes and no. I can't put it into words.
Yeah. So, we're almost done. One more, or
William James has a notion of twice born, you know, of born again, but that it just keeps happening, and it's a way of sort of being bumped back on track when the universe seems to be speaking directly to you. But it could be little things, but it's not just one big awakening. It's a whole journey of reminders and encounters. That's quite fascinating. Anyway. Thank you. Wonderful.
That's okay. Amazing. Well, thank you.
We have a host.
Oh.
Yes.
As Jim so rudely put it, I am the hostess from hell. And actor. There are snacks outside, and there is hot water for tea. Please wash your cup afterward, and I will be going around with the Donna bowl. We meet afterward for lunch if you're interested at the front door.
And there's a sign-up sheet for people who want to receive emails and announcements and other fellowship news. That's right up there on the credenza. Our Donna bowl, which Philip will be coming around, represents an ancient aspect of Buddhism of generosity and compassion, and it's an opportunity to just let it go up. So we hope you will allow yourself that experience. Anywhere from $10 to $1,000. I also want to say that Tom has a wonderful monthly email. Would you call it a blog?
I send out. I do a little column that's in the Bay Times.
Yeah.
And I can. I didn't bring a sign-up sheet. Well, anyway,
Set one up because it's really valuable. How?
It's a biweekly. I send it out.
Examined Life. Right?
Examined Life. Yeah.
And your email is examinedlife@
examlife examlife@aol.com. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can just write and say, put me on the list.
Yeah, it's always worthwhile and helpful. Also, I sing in the San Francisco Choral Society, and in mid-August, April 14th and 15th at St. Ignatius, we're singing Mozart's Requiem, which is one of the great ecstatic pieces ever written. We almost levitate singing it.
It's August, right, not April?
August, of course. It started with May, though, but old mind, too much hassle. And we're also singing Mozart's Vespers, which is a young piece, but it has some absolutely gorgeous stuff in it. So there will be a special combination, so that's the Friday and Saturday night.
Dates again?
Pardon?
Dates again?
August 14th and 15th at St. Ignatius in the evening. Michael, do you want to talk about the...
Yeah. Our annual fall retreat is coming up in September. It's the third weekend, the 18th through the 20th. There are flyers out there. Everyone who's ever attended the retreat has had a mystical experience.
Guaranteed.
It takes place at Vajrapani Institute, which is a beautiful little Tibetan center in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And it's just a really sweet weekend. Our theme is liberation, and our teacher will be David Lewis. So check it out.
Also, Evelyn Underhill's book on mysticism is a knockout.
Yeah.
Anything else? Okay, let's get in a circle. Garrett, you got it.
Sorry about your dedication. By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness, which is without sorrow, and may all live in equanimity, without too much attachment or too much aversion, and live believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.